you're saying that the king gets, besides when he takes the tax, he gets a sixth of their bad, how you say, the demerit of the citizens. But at the same time, as if he protects the citizens, then he gets one sixth of all any of their credit, any of their spiritual benefit or pious activities, he gets a sixth also. And then another one says, and if he doesn't protect them, then he gets all of their bad. Like that. Means basically it would be whoever's acting in that kind of capacity where they're having to protect others. That doesn't mean that you know, a businessman in his business, but it means someone who's creating facility for devotees to do service. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur would consider that it would be engagement of the kshatriya nature for someone who is the temple manager. When he set up his temples, then you had the sannyasis and the pujaris, the preachers and all that, they would be the brahmins. The temple manager would be the kshatriya. And that. So that was, and they worked the temple like that. The manager was different from the preachers and everybody else like that, because he just saw that the day-to-day running and everything. That's very common. That's how most all the mutts in India run. Because you have someone who's like the spiritual head, but they don't get involved in the day-to-day affairs. And then someone else takes care of the finances, legal and office and administrative and all that kind of day-to-day running like that. It's a little bit like how Prabhupada was setting up with the GBC and the temple president. The GBC is supposed to not be involved so much in management, but it's more supposed to see that the standards are kept, you know, preach to the devotees and like that. I think there's one letter where he mentioned that the GBC shouldn't be doing outside programs. They should be preaching to the devotees. Like that. And the temple devotees and that, they can do the outside programs. Because that's more to get somebody in. But the GBC is supposed to be more mature and all that. So they preach to the devotees. They train the devotees. You know, they do that part of the book distribution. You know? Like that.
So another Rupa Prabhupada was talking about how initially he made all GBCs as grihasthas. And he didn't want to give Tamil Krishna Maharaj sannyas because he was a GBC. But then in one letter he mentioned that now the role of the GBC is basically the same as the sannyasis. He's traveling around and giving guidance, not getting involved in the direct management.
Mm. Oh, that's nice. Oh, I see. And then he gave some.
So then it was not a problem for the GBC to be a sannyasis.
Mm.
For that reason, because it was the same type of role.
Mm. That's interesting. So continuing with the ascetic. 59. By eating little and by standing and sitting in solitude, let him restrain his senses if they are attracted by sensual objects. So the eating is also very much connected with the senses. That if one eats too richly or eats too, rajasic kind of eating or eats too much, then it can agitate the senses. I remember once, I think Panchadevita asked Prabhupada about how to control lust, and he said, don't take too much milk products. Because when you take more milk, it creates more. Unless you only take milk, that's another thing. You only live on milk. But otherwise, if all other things are being eaten, if you take a lot of milk products, it increases lust. So like that. Also, some of the South Indian women were telling me that in their home, you know, their mother and their aunts and all that would always tell them is that, you know, you let the, you know, they would cook all, you know, nicely and all this, and they'd say, you know, and all the, like, very rich preparations, then the women would advise the younger girls, they would tell them, don't eat these things. It says, these are for the men, let them eat them. You know, it says, we don't eat them, because otherwise it creates too much lust, you know. That. So, you know, we cook them for them. So eating little and by standing, sitting in solitude. So this would be, this could be also in connection with standing and sitting in solitude would be the chanting of the Gayatri, because that's done standing in the morning and sitting in the evening. So then, and the noon can be either, depends if you're standing in water, you stand, otherwise, you know, if you're on land, you would generally sit. Let him restrain the senses. So the purpose is the senses are trying to be controlled. And it says here, especially if they are attracted by sensual objects. So that means there must be a determination to control. It's not just, it doesn't happen just automatically. One must, means by chanting Hare Krishna, that happens, but there must be that determination that you want that to happen. And when that's there, then the holy name will do so much. He'll do so much anyway. He'll create the interest to have the senses controlled, and then he will control them. But still, in the pastimes, then there must be also that reciprocation. The living entity must take part. So he must also have the interest to try to control the senses, you know. But depending upon the Lord, if he thinks I will control them, then there's a problem. If he understands the Lord will control, then it will work out nicely for him. 60. By the restraint of his senses, by the destruction of love and hatred, and by the abstention from injuring the creatures, he becomes fit for immortality. So love and hatred is something of the material world. This is not talking about transcendental attraction for the Lord. But here it means, because otherwise you cannot destroy the transcendental platform. So you can only the material platform. The love and hatred, this means that when it's overly attached or overly attracted or bewildered, and then hatred, because hatred means bewilderment. So that means that this is a kind of love where there's bewilderment. Affection between devotees and dealings and all that, that's not what it's talking about. This is talking about the attraction where there's bewilderment, where one doesn't actually understand what to do, what not to do. This is the fear. And then the hatred that comes towards obstacles in the way of that affection. You know, if there's somebody who gets in the way of something that you like, and so therefore those who do what you like, you love them, those who don't, you hate them, this and that. So that has to be gotten rid of, because that means you're getting rid of material desire. Then abstention from injuring the creatures is that you don't give problem to anyone, because means that would only happen if there's, on purpose, if there is some desire, there's some material desire, then only you could feel that you're have some superiority or something you want to gain by this. Like that. So this, we restrain the senses, give up the material desires, and are gentle with everybody. Then one becomes fit for immortality. This is the aspect, nadanam najanam nasundarim. And this was it before that. Trinadapi sunichena, tarorapi sahishnuna, amani namana dena. So that verse, if one can embody that verse, then one can get into the spiritual realm. If one doesn't embody that verse, one can even get to the platform of bhava, but you can't get to prema. It's very important. Like that. You can't cross from bhava to prema if that verse is not being practiced. Like that. 61. Let him reflect on the transmigrations of men caused by their sinful deeds, on their falling into hell, and on the torments in the world of Yama. Oh, I see. Oh, these are all the different things he's talking about. On the separation from their dear ones, on their union with hated men, like that, on their being overpowered by age and being tormented with diseases, on the departure of the individual soul from his body and its new birth in another womb, and on its wanderings to 10,000 millions of existences, on the infliction of pain on embodied spirits, which is caused by demerit, and on the gain of eternal bliss, which is caused by the attainment of their highest aim, gained through spiritual merit. By deep meditation, let him recognize the subtle nature of the Supreme Soul and its presence in all organisms, both the highest and the lowest. Whatever order he may be attached, let him, though blemished by a want of the external marks, fulfill his duty equal-minded towards all creatures, for the external mark of the order is not the cause of the acquisition of merit. So here is the, in other words, one has to understand the material world, how it's all just, it's karma, what you are doing, you get a result for that. People are suffering from doing all their different sinful activities, what they do, transmigrations of men means what happens. From this birth they go to the next. Everybody is just moving on like this. There's birth, death, old age, and disease. That even if you look at the bright side of the material world, the emotional side, here then it's mentioning here is the separation from dear ones. Those you want to be with, you get separated from, and then their union with hated men, those people you want to avoid somehow or another, you always end up with, you know. So it's just, overpowered by age, tormented with diseases. So all the things you want don't happen, and all the things you don't want, they always seem to are well arranged, nicely arranged. So, and then how the soul goes from one body to the next, wanders through millions of bodies. And then all the different, and then that the material world is so much difficulty, pain, and suffering, and by spiritual progress, and one can get to the transcendental platform. So then these things should, and then all that, then he should recognize the nature of the super soul and how he's present everywhere. In all living entities, from Brahma down to the Indra Gopa, like that. Yeah, so here then this next point is that whatever order he may be attached here, then let him, though blemished, means he doesn't have the external markings, means here they're talking about the ascetic. It may be something, a general rule, but it also may be here specifically. If it's specifically talking about the sannyasa, there's four levels of that. The kutichak, where they live in a cottage, but they live outside the village. They don't see the family, but somebody from the family comes and brings them their food, and then they just study like that and learn to live alone and take care of themselves. Then bahudak is then when they're practiced at that, then they don't take any more maintenance from the house, but they beg door to door like that. Then when they're accomplished at that, Then they go to Parivrajakacharya. Then they leave their own village and then travel village to village, like this. So, whatever is the order, even though the external markings may not fully be manifest, then still one he has to perform the duties. Like that, because it's the duties that are the actual aspect. It's not the external markings. The external markings help in the performance, help in the identity, help others in understanding, so they relate with you in that way. You know, like that. Like if they see someone dressed as a gentleman, the general tendency is you'll go up and speak like one. You know, if you see somebody very rough and all that, you may speak in another way. So depending upon how the person looks, that's how you're going to deal with them. So if someone has the external markings and it looks very pukka, you have the tendency to be pukka yourself. And if it's not so much, then not. But in any case, the behavior should still be there. The proper behavior should be there. Because that's the actual important aspect. It says the external mark of the order is not the cause of acquisition of merit. It's the performance. Though the fruit of the kataka tree, the clearing nut, makes water clear, yet the latter does not become limpid in consequence of the mention of the fruit's name. What is that? Oh, I see. Yeah. Means the fruit of this kataka tree, when you put it in water, it clears the water. Right? But the water does not become clear when you just say the name of the kataka tree. It doesn't just automatically. Like that. The work has to go on. You have to put the nut into the water. So in the same way, it's just because you have the externals of the sannyas ashram, it doesn't mean that the sannyas, you know, how the function of it is happening. By performing the duties, then the merit that is there happens. Understand? The merit is not gotten just by you put on sannyas dress, then it's not automatically, then one becomes detached, everything like that. It is by doing it, then you get the credit, right? It means if I just take the nut and say, you know, my dear water, I got one of these nuts here, you know, and then suddenly it's going to become clear. No, I have to actually put the nut in the water. Then the water becomes clear. So the activity has to be done. So this in one sense, also would apply to any of the orders like that, this one aspect. Is that whatever it is, the dress is not enough. You know, one has to behave. Then there's some meaning. Because even though the varnashram is external in that it's dealing with the gross and subtle bodies, but it's not so external that it's just the trappings that go in relation to the body like that make the varnas and ashrams, but it's actually the guna and karma, the activities, then it's there. Okay. 68, is it? You want to say something?
I was just thinking that that's why there's so... I wasn't going to say it. Oh. I was just thinking that that's one of the reasons there's so much disturbance in the society, is that people wear the dress, but they don't do it.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's there. That's there. 68. In order to preserve living creatures, let him always by day and night, even with pain to his body, walk carefully scanning the ground. Yeah. It means, in other words, be very careful, don't step on, you know, any living entity, any ants or bugs or snakes or, you know, whatever else. Because they have a habit of walking right out just as you're going to step, you know. 69. In order to expedite the death of those creatures which he unintentionally injures by day or night, an ascetic shall bathe and perform 6 suppressions of the breath. Oh, no, excuse me, not expedite. Expiate. In other words, if he kills some kind of creature, then to remove that sin, then he will take a bath and perform pranayama. That. 70. 3 suppressions of the breath, even, performed according to the rule and accompanied with the recitation of the Vyaharitis, that's the Burbu Vaswa, and of the syllable Om, one must know to be the highest form of austerity for every Brahmana. Like that. In other words, the chanting of the holy name is the most important. So if something happens, once you chant the holy name. 71. For as the impurities of metallic ores melted in the blast of a furnace are consumed, even so the taints of the organs are destroyed through the suppressions of the breath. Let him destroy the taints through suppressions of the breath, the production of sin by fixed attention, all sense attachments by restraining his senses and organs, and all qualities that are not lordly by meditation. Let him recognize by the practice of meditation the progress of the individual soul through the beings of various kinds, a progress hard to understand for unregenerate men. So here, hi, sir. The point here is what's mentioned before in the previous chapter, I think in the second chapter. Then by the chanting of the Omkara, that's the most important. the pranayama, what it does is it makes the mind peaceful. When the mind is peaceful, then the senses are peaceful. So the body becomes peaceful. Therefore, it says all the organs become restrained. The taints of the organs means that they'll be having, you know, so many interests or this or that. So if you can make the mind peaceful, they become peaceful, like that. But for us, just the chanting of the holy name, it does that. We don't rely so, it's not so important for us, the mechanical process of pranayama. Because by chanting the holy name, then that regulation is there. The breath becomes controlled. You take a breath and then you're chanting. And so that means, the pranayama means you're taking the breath in quickly and letting it out slowly. You know, it comes in quickly, letting it out slowly. That is the pranayama. So by chanting, then that same process is going on. It's automatically included in that. Plus, whenever pranayama is going on, it's always being done with mantra. There's no pranayama being done with, at least the Vedic or Pancharatric, without mantra. Like that. The Vedic would be with Om, and the Pancharatric would be with bead syllables. Like that. So it's always, it means the Pancharatric bead syllables. And then the Vedic would be the Om, that's the bead syllable. Then it says, by practice of meditation, meditation means absorbing in one's own, what is happening in oneself. So by the practice of that, seeing what is happening in one's own activities, you know, the reactions of one's own mind, body, senses, like this, then you should be able to see in others how that's working. And this he mentions here. Recognize by the practice of meditation the progress of the individual soul through the various kinds of, through beings of various kinds, a progress hard to understand for others. So one must see how the living entity is progressing through. Means, in other words, one must very much contemplate the whatever Krishna talks about in the Gita, especially the last six chapters, that aspect. So it's more on the jnana. That side must be contemplated very much, like that. Because the karma side has been given up to a great degree. Something is always there. Activity is there. So you never purely have only karma or only jnana. It means there has to be knowledge to perform the karma activities. And there must be some activity even you're doing jnana. You want to sit and read the Vedanta Sutra all day. Still, you must do the process of reading. You are studying scriptures. By studying scriptures, you do get the result of knowledge. So there is some activity and some result like that. But it's just where the emphasis is. Then you'll call it karma jnana. So in the devotional process, this would be karma yoga, means that you're engaging your activities. That's a predominant feature. You're engaging them in the Lord's service. And then jnana yoga means that you're predominantly understanding the workings of the whole process, what's going on. You're seeing the philosophy in the activity that you're doing. Does that make some sense? Like that. So here it's recommending that side of it be the prominent. 74. He who possesses the true insight. True insight into the nature of the world is not fettered by his deeds. But he who is destitute of that insight is drawn into the circle of births and deaths. In other words, you have to see that. Otherwise we think, wow, I went there and I spoke to that one and got that done and then I did this and that. But Krishna says in the Gita that opening and closing the eyes, influencing others, these are all done by the modes of nature. So we had the desire to go speak to somebody to get something done. Krishna sanctioned that, and the modes of nature arranged that you said the right thing. Because we see, sometimes we go and whatever we say, it's always the wrong thing. Right? That means our desire to get that work done was not sanctioned. So the modes of nature, then they arrange. You say all kinds of funny things, or the other person says all the things that you weren't expecting or were hoping they wouldn't say, like that. And then sometimes it does go nicely. So that means it's just Krishna's sanction, the modes of nature, then arranged that you said the right things. Right? The right things came up into the mind, everything happened like that. So that's what's actually going on. So someone who understands that, the nature of the world here, who possesses true insight into the nature of the world, is not fettered by his deeds. But he who is destitute of that sight is drawn into the circle of births and deaths. If you think I'm the doer, I have abilities, you know, then the problem is that, okay, if you're doing it, then you have to, the reaction then is also ours. Like that. And then that fruit is ours, and then we have to enjoy the fruit. So we've done some pious activity, so that gives a pious fruit, so then we have to take birth to enjoy that fruit. Because sometimes these fruits are very great, right? Take prasad, right? You're purified, but it gives so much benefit. So much benefit is there. So if one is not understanding the spiritual, one will advance, but you'll find that, that also just, how do you say, so much, pious results may accrue, because that's what we want. So you have to be very, very careful. When you please, you do devotional service, it pleases Lakshmi. And then she automatically gives facility, because you're using what facility you have in the Lord's service. Like that. And if she's not pleased, she doesn't give. So that's what's actually going on. So now the devotee sees the whole process. The devotee sees my activity, the devotional process, and sees the Lord and Lakshmi, and understands how that all works. I do my activity to please the Lord, then Lakshmi, she gives the facility. Now the karmi, he sees the activity and the result. Right? It's like there's a cloud. So he says, I do this activity and I'm doing it according to the rules. So these rules are made by God. But he just sees, I do this rule and then I get this result. So what it was is I did the activity, Lakshmi is pleased that I followed the Lord's rule, and she gives some small facility, right? Because it's not in proper knowledge. So the result is very small. The karmi thinks it's a very great thing. I did this, I become Indra, I go to the sun planet or the moon planet. That's a very small thing. So all they do is see, I do this thing, and then somehow or another out of this cloud comes the result. But for the devotee, there's no cloud. They understand as I do this for the Lord, and then Lakshmi is giving this result. Right? So there's no real bewilderment there. But because it seems so simple, right? It means the mind and the intelligence, the material, mundane mind and intelligence, they like some kind of mystique, right? As long as there's mystique, there's basically mundane interest. When there's no mystique, one loses that interest. So as long as there's something unknown or don't know or something more, then the interest is kept. And as soon as it becomes known, then, oh, we know this, and you lose interest and want to go into something else. But the whole process, the devotional process, is removing all material mystique. You just know how it works. It just works in this particular way. It's the material world. Then we get into the spiritual mystique. You know, the whole Krishna, his pastimes, and yoga maya, and all these kind of things. This is what is interesting. But the wonderful thing about it, because it is transcendental, we can know what it is, and still be inspired. So the devotees know the process, know what's going on, and they're still inspired. Like that. But at one point, then even that is given up for just love for Krishna. And then nobody cares how it works anymore.
Like what that. Are the mechanics of inspiring others materially? We're talking about everything is working according to the modes that we're desiring. So you see that there are those who are very capable of manipulating material energy and also inspiring others and getting material results from them.
That would just be that they have done whatever activities are important to create that karmic ability in them. Like that, just the conditioned nature, they have performed whatever activities. Like, you know, when we get to the king. The king, if he is very careful to see that those who are improper, you know, the rogues and rascals and that, are caught and punished in this kingdom, then naturally he gains strength and power and influence and fame and so all these things. So someone has done that, so now they have all these qualities. So it just means because of their previous work, then they desire to do it, and it's sanctioned because they're living off the results of that activity. So if they keep going in the proper pious way, then that will then turn more and more into goodness, and then that king will, you know, after so many lifetimes, become a Brahmin. You know, and that Brahmin, after then so many lifetimes, you know, may get interested in liberation, and then after so many more lifetimes may be able to actually endeavor for it, and then after so many more lifetimes may come to the platform of liberation, and then after so many more lifetimes he may actually understand devotional service. So it's a very slow process, very slow process. So Krishna is recommending that you just don't bother like that. You follow the rules and regulations, but not for the material benefits that will come. And just do it to please Krishna. Krishna, he comes to the material world, just does his duty. He has no duty, but he comes and performs duty. He follows his own varnashram system. Right? And without any attachment to the results. And that's what he expects the devotees to do. When the devotees do that, then you're doing what he's doing. So when he comes to the material world, this is what he does. So if you do what he does in the material world, then the next natural thing is when he goes to the spiritual world, then you'll also have the same nature to do whatever he does in the spiritual world. You know? So it just goes hand in hand. He relates nicer with the devotees, this, that, and the devotee will do that. So it's just, he's just asking you just do what he's doing. That's all. To whatever degree we can, it's not expected. But the principle is that we perform our duties, like that. So we see Krishna comes, whatever he is. He's as a king, he does those duties. As a cowherd boy, he does those duties. As a Brahmin, he does those duties. As a sannyasi, as a grihastha, he comes and does all these duties. You know, Brahmacharis, Narayan. You know, he does those duties. Yes.
What about situations where we sacrifice our lower duty for a higher duty? How can we know where we're just copping out on our duty? Like a lot of times we've seen where people have, in the name of preaching, sacrificed their duties that they didn't want to do anyway. And so then, well, but I'm preaching and therefore I can do so many things and I can jump over like a monkey. I've seen this many times.
Yeah.
I still see it.
Yeah.
And then they use the shastra, like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's this, particularly in a household situation, where there was one disciple of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu who was so preoccupied in the Sankirtan mission that he neglected his family. And they were starving or something, and so Lord Chaitanya organized that they would be taken care of because he just couldn't get it together. So they'll use this, well, I'm just so preoccupied in preaching, you know, that I couldn't possibly, you know, do anything at all on my household or duty, nor should I be expected to because it's a lower activity and you're saving humanity. You know, I've seen this.
Well, the thing is that person, I mean, this example that you're giving is that person couldn't use that one as an example because the person that they're giving example from didn't even recognize that. So that they can recognize that I'm doing the higher, sacrificing lower for the higher, that devotee that they're giving example from, that's not the proper example. You know what I'm saying? They're misapplying the example. The devotee in the example is so absorbed, he doesn't even recognize that he's neglecting his family.
Right.
You understand? He's so absorbed, it's obvious to everybody that he's just oblivious to everything. And he's doing nice preaching and this, and everybody's happy. So everybody else then takes care of his family. But here, if the person has a discrimination, no, just like this devotee, I'm going to preach and I'm neglecting my family because this is the higher duty, that means the discrimination is there. That devotee didn't have it. So that's misquoting the scripture. You know, they're misquoting the scripture. It means it's very rare you see this kind of thing. It means generally it would be either inspired by highly devotional or just highly brahminical. Just like Sudama Brahman, he just didn't take care of anything in the house because he was just so absorbed in his study and didn't see that there was a need. But he wasn't expecting any facility either. Someone who's doing that, also then you won't probably see them wearing, you know, well taken care of cloth. They probably won't wear it very nicely. You know, where they stay in that, they don't really care. What facilities you give them, what you give them to eat, they probably won't care. So you have to see that it all matches. Otherwise, if you see this devotee is very particular about, you know, how they dress, where they stay, you know, how everyone deals with them, what is their facilities, what is their position in the whole preaching program, you know, where do they speak, and this one and that one, then they're not on that platform. This is for someone who's just, you know, just so taken the mission just so much and just saw something, just went for it, but he keeps on doing this. I mean, you can come back years later and he's still like that, you know? Or at some point he will realize, oh, I'm not taking care of my family, and then he'll take care of the family. So someone who's so dutiful to the mission can also be dutiful to these lower duties, like that. That's the thing is, you have to see the balance. Because otherwise, then, if later, then they come down from that position, then that has to be recognized and accepted by them that they are not on that position. And then they should be feeling very bad, like we see Ajamil. He left a very, you know, qualified, devoted wife. He left his parents, you know, who were at an age when they required his attention. They had no other support, no other children. And so he was recognizing what a nonsense he was. You know, I mean, by this time it's, you know, a bit late. You know, he's already 88 years old. No, he was 88 when Narayan was born. Yeah, so he probably was, you know, 90s, you know. So it's a bit late, you know. His parents probably aren't around anymore, you know. And his wife, you know, who knows what happened to her. Like that. So that's another thing. But he was lamenting that, you know, like that. And then, yeah. So it's one has to be very, very careful. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is mentioning in this book Bhakti Loka, which is a compilation of essays that he wrote on the Upadeshamrita, two verses of Upadeshamrita, six things favorable to devotional service, six things unfavorable. So in Niyamagraha, he was saying is that every level in devotional service has its what you should do, what you should not do. And you should not move to the next level without, you know, being able to perform the one you're at now. And then you go to the next level and then you see it can be maintained. Because otherwise, if you move too quickly to the next level, there's a chance that you will degrade yourself. Because generally you'll see is that one goes up to a level, one doesn't necessarily just drop back to where he came from, but drops a little bit below that. You know, then with time you'll come up. But one has to know what is the position that you're also coming from, you know.
Well, what about Srila Prabhupada, who he didn't really finish, he always regretted, I didn't get my daughter, there was one daughter that he didn't get married, and he really didn't want to leave the Grihastha ashram, but he thought, well, you know, his dream kept coming, he felt this pressure, you know, that he felt he was being called to do that. I mean, how does a person know that he's not just, you know, of course, Srila Prabhupada's in another category, but we do have being devotees who really feel that, you know, that they can't, they just can't possibly preach and do as fully engaging preaching and at the same time maintain the family. I mean, they can throw the family a few bucks, but to participate as a father or as a husband in a conventional way, somehow or other, they just can't get that together. You know, either they're not advanced enough or controlled enough to be able to do it, or they just, from a dysfunctional childhood, they never saw it done.
Yeah.
A lot of our devotees are suffering because they're from broken homes or dysfunctional families. They don't know how to do it. So it's like, it all gets consumed in the fire of Sankirtan. Let's just do Sankirtan, forget about all this stuff, because we don't really, and life is so short to get into that. You know, it'll be lifetimes before we find a way out of it again. You know, it's like we're the most fallen kind of, it's a rehabilitation program for us, and life is so short. To think in terms of now, it's like 45 or 50, realizing, God, we did it all wrong, now we have to go back and try and patch it. How do you do that, you know? Can you just chant Hare Krishna and be aware and digest it and preach that, boy, we made a boo-boo, don't you make the same boo-boo, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
what is the way to deal with that?
Yeah, well, the most important thing is training the next generations so they know what's going on. So at least, you know, the first generation is the, you know, the only write-offs, you know. But I see two parts, kind of what you were discussing, is that someone says all this, but then they should have, if they were trained properly, then one would think about this before entering into it.
Right.
If one didn't want to put in the time, then they shouldn't get married, because it's a commitment. The time has to be given. If one says, well, I didn't realize what was there, that means one went into it actually uneducated. Because the Bhagavatam very clearly tells what's there. It means there's so many things that are there, so many things you have to watch out for, so many dealings that have to be done. I mean, so many subtle things. If you, like you see, I give this example many times, Swayambhuva Manu, he's getting his daughter married. So then he's found a suitable person. Now he wants the wife and daughter also to feel satisfied. So he's taking them along. Though he's the one that's going to talk and do all the arrangement, but then they can see and then be satisfied it's going on. So this means he took that into consideration, you know, in these dealings and all that. We see Dhruva Maharaj, and he runs into difficulty and all that, so he goes to his authority. You know, he goes to his mother. And then she then guides him, you know, what you should do, and at least whatever she knows, like that. So, in other words, when there is difficulty, one goes to authority. Like that. So we see in Prabhupada's case is that all these different signs and all that came, but then also in discussion with God brothers and all that, that also they confirmed these things. So then, because otherwise he also quoted the verse that... I think Raghunath Das about the though he was not inclined, but then by the, I'm not sure who it was, by the grace of Sanatana Goswami, then he took the, you know, the very bitter medicine of sannyas and like this. But this is always serious, you know, consideration. In other words, they're able to do it properly. Prabhupada is able to run the family nicely. Problem was, is that the wife was not overly interested in devotional activities. You know, if she had probably been a little more cooperative in that way, then it would have been more favorable. Otherwise, Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions in the Janasangha that in associating with those who are not qualified, says if the wife is Krishna conscious and there's a cooperation in Krishna consciousness, and there's no need to you know, prematurely leave the house. But if wife is not, then he says very tactfully, then one has to somehow know to get oneself out of the situation. But even there, he's not saying it's done in just a blunt way. You know, there must be some proper arrangement. So that's a fine thing, but generally it's in association with others. It means we ourselves have to be trained. We associate with others who are trained like that. So that naturally then brings us to the second part is, what does one do if one is not trained?
Yeah, and probably threw people together who didn't even know each other. You saw a few
people there. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, because the technical thing is it's, how you say? You see, it's oil and water. So whether it's, what do you call it, mustard oil or olive oil or, you know, safflower oil or like, it still doesn't mix. You can only mix it for a time. You know, you shake it up and it makes a nice dressing for some time, but if you let it sit after a while, it separates again. It's just the nature. So, you know, Prabhupada's basically we see is his idea was this, that the couples would move through the whole ashram as quickly as possible. Like that. In that, the idea, he was even thinking that it could be by the, you know, chanting the holy name very nicely and by the proper establishment of the Gurukul system, the parents could actually get themselves in Dvainaprastha in like 5-6 years. You know? Is that he mentions that after 1 or 2 years, when the children, I mean, no, it's not 1 or 2 years. After 1 or 2 children, then when the children are of the age to go to start going to the Gurukuls, because that time they were, we were all boarding, is that then the husband, he could move into the temple and stay with other such like-minded men. He wouldn't move in with the, brahmacharis, but he would move into other such men, who were family men. And then stay there. He would still take care of the wife and that, and they would still deal in everything. But it would just be that he would kind of like absorb himself more in service there, and then the wife has her place. So they both get the benefit of like more time to themselves, more time for their own study and their own chanting and that. While for the man in the temple, they feel comfortable, living with others like that, and while the women feel comfortable if they have their own space like that. So both were getting what they wanted, and then they can engage themselves much more in service because the children aren't there. They don't have to worry about, maintaining all kinds of things and like that. So then that would go on, and then from there that would go until such time as if it was seen that to go to sannyas, or it would just continue like that. But I think the idea was is it would go, he was seeing in the beginning, things could be gone through quicker. Because basically what he established in the beginning was just the aspect of just the sadhana. He just had the brahmacharis and the sadhana bhakti, and just those aspects only. They were chanting, they were hearing Bhagavatam, they were taking prasad. They were doing some, very beginning not, but at some point they would start coming to the artik ceremony or bells, they would go like that. So they're basically, what you see is that they were just doing the sadhana aspect. Then with time, when he saw that the women were also very, interested and inquisitive, then he introduced the next aspect of working for Krishna, the Varnashram, but only the Brahminical part of it. Because this point was, in the beginning we have to establish Brahmins. So then the Brahminical aspect is there, so you have one Varna, but you have 4 ashrams. Because the Brahmin goes through all 4. And then, that was established also quite soon in the beginning. Then we see in the later 70s when he saw that the devotees couldn't catch the essence of chanting and the emphasis on that side and that cooperation together as devotees, and they got more bewildered by the men and women relationship all these different things, and they couldn't actually satisfy themselves in chanting and preaching and deity worship and, you know, book distribution and, you know, working, making books and things that are just, everything's just in, you know, sacrifice on the altar of Sankirtan. Then he started talking more and more about Varnashram. But he's already established all four ashrams, and he's established Brahmins. So when he says you have to understand, make this Varnashram, means that you have to add in Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudras, basically. And even he had established, like, managers, and he had even made businessmen. You know, the spiritual sky was there, Govinda's restaurants were there, and then, you know, devotees had the bliss bars.
He had farms also.
Yeah, so those things were there. But then it was all kind of like, okay, then we can't just, in that very nice, light, devotional mood, move through these things and go back to Godhead quickly. Then it just kept adding more, you know, add in these other things. So we had all the varnas and all the ashrams. And that, then he was just saying, even this is not, the Westerners are much more contaminated in that than. So then it's like the emphasis is on Varnashram, means where the performance of occupational duties and going through the whole natural rigmarole, you know, marriage is, you know, so many years and this and that and all the different things. So then, so the external trappings of it and the movement of the time of it then slows way down. You know, so instead of just moving everyone through basically to, you know, basically humses in a few years. You know, he was thinking by 75 we'll have devotees who have Bhaktivedanta, they'll be qualified to be gurus and all this. You know, so then he was, because in the beginning we saw the enthusiasm and the dedication, if devotees could continue that without making any offenses, then so much could be done. But whatever, lack of qualification. And so then the basic thing is, yeah, that's the difficulty. So one has to be realistic and realize where one's at. You know? Because the point is, if one has difficulty in the house, one has problems and this and that, one doesn't know how to relate and can't figure out how to hold it all together, but then one has to recognize that and just say, this is actually the problem. So now we look for a solution. Of course, one can look for just when one just takes sannyas, and then, but that's not actually the solution, because here it's mentioned, you put on the externals of it, then it doesn't necessarily mean one is a sannyas, you know. But one has to have the nature of it, right? The what do you call it? The water is being cleared because this particular fruit has the ability to make the water clear. Like that. It's not just some external. You know? You just say the name and by magic, no. So it's not just by taking the dhoti and ripping it in half and then suddenly some magic. And then. So then recognizing that, then one would discuss with devotees how that can be done, and discuss with the family members. And then everybody can be kind of like tuned in, and they may have to, how you say, simplify their lifestyle, or, you know, in some way kind of adjust things in a cooperative way to make it where everybody can function, or find some way that it can be done, find another situation, or find, take advice from others, or get training, or whatever has to be done. But that takes maturity. That's the difficulty. You know, the whole process takes maturity. Means it's interesting in the samskars. Means, yeah. I say, the devotee means, pranipata means you have to desire, you have to want. Like that. So the spiritual activities you have to want. So therefore there must be that contemplation and all that. So it's the thing, we see Prahlad Maharaj at 5 wanted. You know, Dhruva Maharaj, I think he was 5 or 6, he wanted. so then they're able to get. But if that want is not there, then getting won't come either. Because the difficulty in the whole, the main difficulty in the devotional process and also in the Varnashram process, because it's based on the devotional process, it's stemming from there. The one common principle that is very difficult for the Western paradigm, basically anybody, but especially the Western paradigm, is that it starts with yourself. See, generally, the concept is okay, I want to do this, I have to change all the externals around me, and then it'll happen. But the Vedic concept is, I change myself, that will automatically change the surroundings. Right? It's like, let's say I have so much money, and I'm surrounded by all kinds of people that, you know, are very flaky. So now I can just try to get rid of all those people and, you know, make all kinds of changes in the externals. But the problem is the money is still there. If I give up that money, then all those people won't be around because they're only interested in the money. You know? But we generally don't want that. We want to leave ourselves the way we are. And we want to just kind of superficially change things. We wouldn't just change what's going on the outside. We're not worried about changing what's going on the inside. The Vedic system is the gross comes from the subtle. You change the inside, the outside changes automatically. You know? So that's the problem. If you chant Hare Krishna, this way Prabhupada wouldn't worry. You know, he just goes to some place and you have all these crazy hippies in that. They just chant Hare Krishna, just take prasad. He knows within time, then all the other steps will naturally come. You know? Then, you know, he doesn't worry if they wear dhotis or they shave their heads or this or that. It's just, you just go on like this, and then by going on like this, it'll automatically come. Because as the heart becomes purified, then consciousness will change, then with that everything else changes. So that's the principle there. We have to change yourself. So then that's the thing, is if there's something wrong in the family life, we have to see in ourselves what is wrong. Like that. And if by checking we see we are doing everything properly, but the other members of the family somehow or another aren't very qualified or aren't really trying or interested in Krishna consciousness or interested in making things work, then that's another thing. And one can take advice from others what one should do. But if everybody's willing to take part, then everybody has to start seeing what's going on. You know, what is their motives for doing things, why they're doing the things. And then take it from there. Because the ultimate answer will be very, very difficult. Point is, does that get anywhere?
That does help. The question comes to my mind as an adult. That explanation is, there are situations where, because you have the Vedic society, the Vedic system where the woman is supposed to take shelter of the husband. You have so often the husband who's himself not able to follow the principles, or he indulges either through sense gratification, or he's on the other side totally impersonal and not able to relate on that. You've got these two extremes. And I've seen many situations where the woman is kind of trying to hang in there to keep the family, you know, trying to keep it together. Both of them are devotees, kind of, or one is stronger than the other. But at a certain stage, you've tried it this way, you've tried it that way, you've tried it this way. It sort of doesn't really, you know, after so many years you decide, well, let me start now to really make my relationship with Krishna. I've tried so hard to work this thing out, you know, and it's like, now you're almost 50 and you think, well, how much more energy? Does it really matter in the course of eternity whether you got your marriage together or not?
It doesn't.
You know, I'm just saying, is it... would it be considered unchaste for a woman just to say, look, I've done it, there's as much as I can do. Like Yamuna, I remember there was a time when Prabhupada said, oh, now Yamuna, your wife has taken sannyas, now you must take sannyas to Gurudas. That when they kind of, and it's unusual for the woman to do that in the Vedic society. Usually the woman stays at home with the children.
Mm.
And the husband, he's doing all that. But sometimes it doesn't happen like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's there.
So how do you, how, I mean, not because you have to understand that in the situation we've been married for 25 to 30 years, there's a lot of, the long period of time, we've got impressions and memories and all kinds of things going on like that. That if you decide to separate, I guess it's a kind of a glorified divorce. I don't know what we call. I mean, we.
No, it's not. It's just called separation.
Well,
this divorce concept, something else.
Well, but the thing is that whether sometimes it is like that. You said this the other night how awkward it is getting out of the material world. It was like that with our parents. It'll be like that. It's like that with your kids, getting them sorted out and getting. So I wonder though. Because there are, it appears, you're dealing with devotees, there appears to be aparads incurred, you know, especially in relationships that are so involved that you have, in your mind, you have arguments and things you've said that you wish you'd never said and all kinds of things that at the point of death you may just, well, your mind may go, be drawn to that rather than Krishna because there's so many things you could not and cannot possibly resolve. So I just wonder if is there some Vedic technique, or I mean, at one stage you just decide, okay, I did what I could do. This is as far as I take it. Now let me really throw myself into my relationship with Krishna, because although your family and Krishna consciousness is, it's definitely dovetailed. They're devotees. You've tried to make, you know, it's all been centered on Krishna. The marriages are arranged. Everything was 50 round babies and all that stuff. But still. It's a bit of a, as you get older, you see that labor of love becomes a burden, you know, you just don't have the energy to fan the egos and do all the, you know, it's just, you get tired and it's about all you can do to survive yourself. So I wonder now, if like Prabhupada, he decided, his wife made this joke, okay, I'd rather have tea than you, and he took it. I mean, she was probably just joking at that point. And thought he'd be back in a half an hour, you know, and he never came back. But as far as I understand from the Lilamrita, he was extremely emotionally. It took him some days to steady himself. He sat and chanted, and I just wonder, you know, for she wasn't a, I mean, she must have been some sort of a devotee. It wasn't that she was just a demon, you know, she was a vegetarian.
As one devotee pointed out, she was the first one to distribute Prabhupada's books.
Yeah.
She was also initiated. She was also initiated.
But by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati.
No, she was initiated by one of his disciples from Krishna
Murti. Oh, I see, but in the Gaudiya Mutt.
Yeah, in the Gaudiya Mutt.
I mean, anyway, my question only is that because you're dealing with devotees about Vaishnava Parad, how does one do this properly? You know, that because there is a period from householder life to full renunciation, there's definitely a period of oscillation. It's like you have one step forward, two steps back, you know. When you're fried with it all, you decide, oh, chuck it, it's Krishna. And when it's going nice, you think, well, maybe it's something nice here. So how does one actually come to this resolute mentality that you just decide, Krishna, it's all the way, you know? Because it's all mixed around with Krishna, but we are mixed devotees. We want to come to the full platform, full surrender before we leave our bodies. So what would you say to that?
The... Basically, is it means like what you've. Let me say. That's actually the natural process of what the ashram is for. Because even if everything went perfectly, smoothly, and wonderfully, the same conclusion is going to be come to. But. It's just, if everything goes smoothly, there's less doubt. You know, you don't have the thing of sometimes it's rough and then sometimes it goes, then it's a little better than, you know, well, maybe there's something here and that. The whole idea of the Vedic system is everybody's been trained nicely, does their duties nicely, so when they go through it, everybody's did everything wonderfully and then comes to the same conclusion.
You have no regret.
Yeah, there's no regret because you did everything. It was a, you know, very nice relationship. You know, everything and the kids and all the duties, everything went perfect. Like you see Kardama and Devahuti. There's no sign of any improperness in that whole, or disturbance in that whole marriage. Nothing. Everything was perfect. They had a perfect child. That means their consciousness was perfect. Everything was wonderful. But as soon as Kapila said he would take care of his mother and instruct his mother, his father immediately left. So that means that, you know, all that, whatever was to be gained, because as a brahmachari, he would be a perfect example of upakurvana. So he studied, you know, he understands, and he sees that these attachments are there, and he wants to get through them. And he prays to the Lord also that I'll go through this and I'll come out with, you know, very resolute determination for devotional service. And so then that happened by the Lord's grace. So it's just that one figures it out. Generally, the whole idea is normally like around 50, one figures this out. And then one moves on. It doesn't have to be, how you say, you know, the traditional, you know, slamming doors and, you know, driving off in cars and all this kind of stuff like that. Packing suitcases in 30 seconds and all that kind of stuff. But it's just a matter of, you know, it's a matter of it's just seen that this is what's coming up. And then it would be the natural thing is the husband and wife would be discussing this and observing it. And they're neither disturbed by it, because they know that ultimately it's not anybody's fault. It's just that the trying to gain something out of the material energy doesn't give the satisfaction. So it's not that the other person wasn't very nice or very wonderful and didn't do their duties, and there wasn't. So from having worked on a project for so long, that natural attachment is there. You know, one is work, one is done, and that, you know, because grihasana is like a project that is being done. At the same time, as it's understood, is that the project has done what it's supposed to do, and that is that you understand that this is not where the real satisfaction lies. It's in Krishna. So then, when it comes to that point, then that's what's called vanaprastha, and then that takes however long it takes to get that complete, resolute determination that it's just, you know, just you know, my sadhana, my devotion to Krishna, my service, and that's all. And then husband and wife don't require that help from each other anymore. So in the Vedic culture, that can also be another 25 years. So that can be as long as it was in the Grihastha ashram. So that's not, many times it's just thought Grihastha, Vanaprastha, they just separate and don't deal with each other and this and that. That doesn't have to be. It means they may stay together and just in this way get into their own development and discussing that and taking advantage. But now it's more on the level of satsang rather than the husband and wife. Or they may also spend time not with each other so that they can get used to that or get more absorbed in their service or whatever's their interest. It depends upon what their interests are, if they're something common or in the same place or if they're in different places. But that doesn't have to be something also fast. That can go on for years, you know, until it's completely seen as now without any of the support of this, then one can just completely just dedicate oneself. So it's discussion is important, you know. And what you're saying, if things in the past, if it's possible, then it's in Harinam Chintamani Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions that it, on offenses and things like this to other persons, the ideal is as if there's an opportunity or one has the ability to be able to go to that person and explain and actually, you know, beg forgiveness or feel remorseful about, at least feel remorseful if one can't go to the person. But the best is one can go, because that clears it very quickly.
But there's no need for a whole this elaborate discussion on it, maybe. It's just sort of...
Depends. It's that would be very individual. The main thing is just that we felt that this was wrong, and this and that. You can even say, I don't think it's worth discussing, but you know, it's just, I feel this, and this was done wrong, and I feel bad. But the best thing is just discuss what one feels oneself did wrong.
Right.
Don't bring up that I think you did this wrong. That will naturally come from their part, either today or tomorrow, or if it doesn't, it doesn't matter. You know, but point is you want to clear yourself. See, the thing is in here is the ego. That's why it's from the, as early as possible that one can work on this Trinada Pisu Nichena verse, the teachings of that verse, then everything goes nicely. Because to run the Grihastha Ashram nicely, then the ego can't be predominant. And to deal in this kind of things, in the Vanaprastha, and to, you know, beg others for forgiveness, then the ego can't be there, you know. So it's got to be, we just see what I did wrong in it. The other person may have also done wrong, but that's between them and Krishna, you know. It's what I've done wrong, that's between me and Krishna. So I should at least say, I'm sorry for this. And it should be heartfelt, and it shouldn't be, well, I said it now, you know, it's your turn to, you know. It has, you know, one has to go into it with the idea is that I just do my side. The other that doesn't, that's another thing. Then one can do that. If one can't, either the opportunity does arise, or it's just somehow or another, just very, the situation is just very difficult, or it, you know, from experience, you know, it, you won't get anywhere. Then it says you have to very seriously take shelter of chanting the holy name. And that means also in reality, you know, it's just really absorb yourself in chanting, trying to develop a taste in the holy name, trying to, you know, very consciously avoid committing any offenses. Then with time, because that'll take longer, with time, that will be removed. But
the offense,
but it very much depends upon your commitment to the holy name. Like that. I mean, if you just say, oh, I'll chant Hare Krishna and all that, then that means the proper feeling of remorse is not there. Because, you know, it's just that we're here in the material world is lamentable. You know, we left Krishna. Prabhupada in the lecture, I think, was in September, New Vrindavan 72. Just reading it today. He was saying that the, you know, giving the example of the rich man has a son that leaves, and so then the father sees the son is out on the street and suffering, so he wants to bring him back because he has the facility to take care. He mentions there is that, you know, Krishna's, you know, thinking, you know, this rascal has gone away and now is suffering, but he should come back, I'll take care of him. You know, I have all the facilities, everything. And Prabhupada mentions that, you know, God wants to take care because of his affection for us. So he wants to see that it's taken care of and everything is very nice. But we have to want that. We have to make that choice to take up the chanting properly and all that. Then it will be there. We can't just say it. We actually have to commit ourselves to it.
There was, do you remember, I think it was a year ago, Lloyd Thatcher died at our house. And you came, I think you came and saw him.
I came with Govindamaraj.
Right. And, well, you left, but the week went on. As the week progressed, a couple of days before he died, some young girl who had been offended by him something like 7-10 years before, when she was a young girl, he was a temple president somewhere, she wrote this letter. And she was, she felt that she had to clear this, whatever this offense was, with him before he died. Many devotees said, well, this is the appropriate thing if the person's, you know, before he dies, so that he doesn't have to come back or something, that you clear these things before a person. And other devotees said, well, but it's kind of, you know, you're on your deathbed, you're already suffering, so to hear all of this is very, it complicates the issue. So this is kind of what I'm worried about, is that when you are suffering, your mind tends to go to all the pain you caused others, you know, it's somehow the way the purification works when you're suffering.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how deeply you have to clear things with people so that your mind doesn't be attracted to all these things and not the Krishna.
The sooner the better. Because the idea is that shouldn't be what's coming up at death. That should already be coming up, you know, in life before that. means it's like
you have to clear it clean behind yourself then.
Yeah. Means this is one should be contemplative of, that's why it mentions here, meditative.
Yeah.
Of oneself, what's going on, how things work, relationships, all that. So one has to see. So when that comes up in the mind, then one should start going through what one has done and all these things. And then, you know, if possible, then... See, there's some things that it's just a matter of you understand what's wrong and just try to commit yourself to correcting whatever that is, you know, in our own mentality. And then if the opportunity arises, then we can, you know... beg forgiveness, like that. If one feels a very strong urge, then one can make an endeavor to go and do all that.
And it would seem that if we actually want it to be, this contemplation to be a transcendental activity, then it has to be based on our reading, otherwise it can just become mental platform.
Yeah, like, no, that's very good. It has to be based on the Shastra. Yeah. It's there, but the point is we... I have to understand that we do so many things wrong, and we may have upset so many people. So then, we should just try to become dependent upon Guru and Krishna, and try to become fixed in chanting the holy name. Because whatever we do, if it doesn't increase our faith in the process and our dedication to the chanting, it's not really worthwhile. That's the main symptom, is that if it helps our chanting, you know, our hearing and chanting, our associating with devotees, then that's really worthwhile. And if it restricts that, then it's not so good.
Another thing we find with the acharyas is that they're very aware of death.
Yeah.
That they're, you know, they're very often praying for appropriate death.
Yeah. You remember the Lord. You don't remember all the... You know, didn't give a cookie to our kid when he wanted one or something like that. Yeah. Because those things is just, we just see, it's not the thing, the point is it's not the thing that's important. The activities are a medium. The point is the difficulty is there if we haven't done the duties properly. Many times we see it's just a lack of Krishna consciousness. So the real lamentation is we weren't Krishna conscious. And so we have to try to become. You know, it's not the big problem, you know, the whole material world is going to turn upside down because in a certain situation, certain of the activities weren't done properly. That by it not being done properly, that's symptomatic of our consciousness. So that's the real thing that has to be corrected, is the consciousness. See, the karmi is very worried about the activity itself. So then, you know, at the end of life, then they do some special yajnas and special charities like that, specific charities, so that anything that's, any problems that are there, that it'll at least, they'll properly get through, you know, to the next life and all those things without too much difficulty. You know, they'll be able to go to see Yamaraj and dignity rather than have to wade through the Vaitarani River or, you know, have to swim across or get drowned in it or something like that. So they're worried about all these things. But for the devotee is that the etiquettes and all the rules are just a medium through which exchange can go on. So if the exchange wasn't proper, it's not so much the thing that was done that is the main problem. It's the mentality was wrong that therefore created that. So you may have one wrong mentality and that's created hundreds of difficulties. So if you can correct that one mentality, those 100 difficulties, the cause of those things will go away. One won't do those anymore.
Gita, Krishna explains that that correction of the main mentality problem is to, and to come to the Paramahansa stage, is to actually observe Paramatma within the being empty. And to actually consciously think that when you deal and see others, regardless of their form. Mm. So that rather than be concerned with so many, you know, like so much with just a few living entities, which you call your family, and if you expand it out to Krishna's family and see how you're relating on all levels. Mm. Because we're not going to have to only face how we dealt with a few people, we're going to have to face how we dealt with everybody.
Hmm.
Hmm. It's very explicit in one chapter of Uddhava Gita, but in the Bhakti Yoga chapter, the essence is to understand that Krishna is in the heart of the reality.
Hmm.
And to relate on it.
Hmm. 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 Does that get anywhere, Martin?
Yeah.
Who's that? Making chandan. Then 75. By not injuring any creatures, by detaching the senses from objects of enjoyment, by the rites prescribed in the Vedas, and by rigorously practicing austerities, men gain that state even in this world. So one is able to come to the transcendental platform. In this lifetime, Prabhupada many times would say that even in this lifetime, one can come to the platform of prema, one can enter into the spiritual world, one can actually have one's eternal relationship with Krishna. But one needs these, you know, performance of the here, then by not injuring any creatures, then this is what Matiti was mentioning here, with the reason that it wouldn't, you would see the super soul in every living entity. And you would see that the soul is there, that they are part and parcel of Krishna. And just due to their desires, they have taken on this form. You know, the form itself doesn't matter. It's a living entity who has manifest because of desires, this form. But so it's just, one sees that there's a living entity there that has desire. But that's... Then performance of one's duties, then one gets these realizations. And by practicing austerity, so the main austerity is, you know, the chanting of the holy name, you know, following of the Vaishnava etiquette. Then one is able to come to the transcendental platform. Let him quit this dwelling composed of the five elements, where the bones are the beams, which is held together by tendons instead of cords, where the flesh and the blood are the mortar, which is thatched with the skin, which is foul-smelling, filled with urine and stool, infested by old age and sorrow, the seat of disease, harassed by pain, gloomy with passion, and perishable. He who leaves this body, be it by necessity, as a tree that is torn from the river bank, or freely like a bird that quits a tree, is freed from the misery of this world, dreadful. Freed from the misery of this world dreadful like a shark. So here is means in either way is when, in other words, we see the body as a burden, it's just some place we're living. And it gives the how it's built. And the bones are all your beams and all this structure, and the tendons are everything, how you tie everything together, and then it's thatched with the skin. You know, it's a nice covering on the, like that. So, but here it says that there's two ways to go. Either by necessity, as a tree is torn from the riverbank, you know, the river just, the water just washes away the dirt until the tree caves in. In other words, we leave by force, just, you know, old age is there and we die. Or, it says like a tree from a bird, the bird flies out if we're to that platform where we can leave whenever we like. But in any case, that, then one's freed from the misery of the material world, you know, which is like a shark that comes to devour one. When by the disposition of his heart he becomes indifferent to all objects, he obtains eternal happiness both in this world and after death. So indifference to all objects means if it's, there's no attraction or repulsion. They're all just objects. There's nothing to do with, you know, with specific attraction or value or anything. If it can be used in some service, he has a service and it can be used in that service, it's useful, then he uses it. But it's not because of attraction. And if not, then he doesn't use it. He doesn't just take it just because he's attracted by it. This is a very important aspect. By the disposition of his heart means that this is just his realization. He has no material desire. He is indifferent to all objects. He attains eternal happiness, both in this world and after death. Because in this world there's no problems. And then one is not attached to here, then one can be very easily attached to Krishna. Means the main thing that gets in the way of our being attached to Krishna is our attachment to the material world. So when that is removed, then our attachment to Krishna is there. So for the devotee, for the non-devotee, he practices these one after the other. He becomes detached from the world, and then if he's fortunate, he may come in contact with the devotees and then become attached to Krishna. But that's not so often. Like the four Kumaras, they were just detached from the material world. They had no attachment for Krishna. Like that. But the devotional process is you're cultivating simultaneously attachment to Krishna, so that is taking one's attention away from the material world, and you are cultivating the knowledge of the material world, so you see that it's not a place to be in. So then, you know, simultaneously it's both going on very quickly. But this aspect of indifference means if it's useful to service, you keep it. If it's not useful, it's not important. One doesn't keep it just to keep it. You know, one's enamored by it. It's something you like, or it's far out, or this or that. It means if it's useful, it's used. It would be nonsense to give it up. If you have a service and it needs some paraphernalia or some facility, then that must be used. You have it, Krishna sends it, you use it. You know, one does not artificially renounce things that are not useful. At the same time is, then one, one is not attracted by things that one doesn't require for the service. Any other questions on all this, or?
About three things that one may need, three things that one has become attached to keeping. It might have been a need to start with, and then these things have been kept. That's my problem. I have things which I don't use for the moment.
self needed.
I keep them because they are Krishna consciously. Is there a way you can really be systematic?
If you want to get rid of it, I can tell you ways to do it. But see, that is one of the aspects. See, the brahmachari, the especially brahmachari, vanaprastha sannyas, then they generally will tend towards the getting rid of. Mm-hmm. The grihastha is given a little bit more space, especially if it's things, you know, it's like that may come up and this and that. So it's kind of more, but when it should be more of that. It could actually be used practically, could happen. Not just the maybe, but this, that. So the whole process is, as you go through, and after, you know, 25 years, then you figure, I haven't used it for 20 years, so maybe I don't need it. You know, mm-hmm. Then you're able to start giving up. That's why in Vanaprastha, the process of starts. But otherwise, if one is looking to simplify life, then generally I found very easy is you just, you mainly have to see if it's useful or not. And you've established it's useful. So then you have to, means things that you see aren't useful, you should just get rid of. What is useful, then you have to then consider, is it something you're going to need or if not? You know, if not, then, you know, it must be engaged properly by somebody. If it is, then it should be regularly reviewed and just see if it is. It means if regularly you're checking, then you can see. Does that make some sense?
Yes. And another, just on the same point, another senior devotee, he mentioned that for system for himself, is that if it's something that he uses all the time, then it's something to keep. But if it's something you use rarely or sometimes, then you may just want to borrow it from somebody than just to you have it, you know, harboring it. And I found that to be a very good way, you know, when you're looking around at your junk. You're attached to this pot or something and you never use it, maybe once in a year on this. You know, get rid of it or put it somewhere where you can always borrow it, like, or books, put it in the library. You don't have to store them or possess them. And everybody else can enjoy them, but you can also enjoy them in the library.
That's very good.
Another way to do it.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Main thing is you have to be unscrupulous.
Unscrupulous means?
In going through. You can't, you just... means you have to be ruthless.
You know. Luggage.
You know, especially closets. Closets have to be waded into ruthlessly. You have to go through everything one by one. You have to take it out and look at it. Is it useful or not? If it's not useful, you put it in the throw-out pile. If it's useful, then you put it aside. Until you've gotten rid of, you've figured out what's, throw all that away. Then what's there, then you look at that. And then like what Mataji just said, is this something I regularly use, need this? Then we keep it. And if it's not, then we find some good way to, it can be engaged in Krishna's service. We can't just neglect it. But we have to see this being, and then that way you can cut down a lot. You know? But basically you have to think about each thing, you know, from this angle that Mataji mentioned. Is it used, not, this, that? Rather than it's a great thing, it's nice, it's a good thing, it's valuable. That's there, but the thing is if it's valuable to us.
And no, just another point, because I'm working on that point as well, about grabbing things and owning things. But the Buddhists, they say that that's the whole thing that keeps us bound in the material world, that we have, the living entity has the propensity to grasp. You know, you can...
you go into a beautiful setting and you think, I'd like to have a house here, and you know the push is that you should buy a piece of land and then build a thing on it, and then, you know, after a week you're fed up with the place. But that's the push. Somehow this thing, you're attracted to a thing, you buy it, but then you have to haul it around with you. So if we can resist this push to own the thing, I mean, just why not share it with somebody? Or, you know, or that's the beauty of what Prabhupada's given us, is we can go from place to place and be in a house and eat and sleep, but we don't have to get entangled in that owning thing.
Yeah.
So that's a big push, a gravity push.
Very nice point. It's very interesting if we look at it very early days, is that the situation that Prabhupada created for the grihasthas was like, so they were practically on the liberated platform themselves, because, you know, you had a common building, you know, the cooking was all done in the common place, you know, it was, you didn't have to own your own pots and pans, your own furniture, anything like this and that. Many times, depends on the temple. Some they lived, you know, they had a room. Some they didn't. They lived in different places or like this. So everything was just common and shared, and everyone took advantage. But then, that takes a lot of, how you say, training and purity to be able to live on that platform. Means you would see it. Someone may say, well, it's not natural, but then if you actually look at it, it's actually the most natural. If you go back, you know, even a few years in India, you have the joint family. So joint families have this monster house. The monster house has one kitchen, and that's the kitchen for all the 10 families that live there, you know, the mother and father, and then their 10 sons, and then their wives and kids, and so the 50 people or more that live in that house, there's one kitchen, and all the cooking happens in that kitchen. You know, all their money goes together, whoever's the head of the family, then the money is all going there, and all the sons go out and work, and then all the money's turned over to whoever runs the money in the house, the mother or the grandmother or someone. And then with that, then all the things are bought, then cooking goes on, everybody's fed, and, you know, different things that everybody needs, that money is kind of like shifted around, you know, and no one really even knows what's going on. Like one devotee was telling me that in their family, the grandmother, in the back in the village where everybody used to live, now they've all moved out, but it's like you had so many brothers and they're all doing their duty, like if one of them loses a job or something, then only the grandmother would know that. And she would see that everything's going on, because others are making money and things have been put away, so she's pulling out of that and taking care. And then he's going out and looking for his job and all that. When he's situated again, then he starts putting money back in. But no one knows, you know, about this. You know, so it's all... So these things of the commonality that you didn't have to, you know, everybody's got to have their own house, their own kitchen, their own everything. It's not actually natural, even from the grihastha point of view, like that. So what Prabhupada meant was the joint family was the temple, and all the facilities of the big house and all the different things were there. So it's very easy for Prabhupada. He wanted to give what was the best. It's natural. The father gives what's the best to the children. So the kind of situation that Prabhupada would have grown up in and everybody else grew up in, of these big joint families and that, he just established that in the temples.
But we were supposed to join Krishna's family.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't have a family, so he was trying to create that.
Yeah, you know. Some will also, yeah. So it's just a matter of creating that atmosphere. And then everybody can work. Because in the very early days, it worked nicely. But then as the, you know, tendency to grab and possess increased, then everything breaks up, you know. The joint family breaks up into nuclear families, you know.
Also in the temples...
Speak a little louder, please.
In the temples, principle is really nice if everyone is trained the same way.
Yes.
But if everybody is different, then it becomes chaotic.
Yes. Well, the whole that's a very good point. Prabhupada's whole emphasis was on training. So it was supposed to be that everybody was trained. Remember in the early, like in 73, we had our temple, and then we were going to another temple. We were driving, the whole temple went to other temple. When you get to the other temple, you feel in it as you did in your own temple. Kind of in those days, it was ISKCON. All the temples were our places to stay. It's like all the just different places. They were just all one family. So you went there, and when you got there, then you would, you'd get there, and then you'd go find the president or the temple commander, tell them you're there, and you're here for a couple of days, you're going somewhere else, and what service can they do? And then while you were there in the temple, you worked under the direction of those temple authorities, they told you what to do, and some were helping with the cooking, or some were going out on Sankirtan, and some were cleaning the temple, and like that, and you did that. And you felt just as much home in that temple as you did in your own. Like that. So it was happening. But the thing is, unless the training remains, then, why it works so nicely, even though we say it was very simple, is because Prabhupada trains, he starts from he gives the conclusions and their purposes first. And then you can fill out the details unlimitedly. But even though there's unlimited details, they don't have as much weight as the conclusions and their purposes. Like that. But unfortunately, the kind of the Western mentality is being enamored by the unlimited or vast amounts of details, and that is what is substance. But the fundamentals, those are the real thing. So the fundamentals you can give to anybody very quickly, like that. Then you fill that out with the details and all that they have the. They can apply it in every situation. So devotees learned that, and they knew how to apply it in a few situations. But then when they ran into other situations, they didn't know how to apply it. So instead of trying to, contemplate or try to take advantage of others' advice, or maybe one did, but one didn't come to a proper understanding, one didn't know how to apply it there. So then the tendency is, oh, Krishna consciousness doesn't work here, and so therefore we have to bring in something from somewhere else. And so therefore it's very simplistic and just very simple and all that. But actually the essence is the simple part. Essence is the simple part. So that's what Prabhupada gave. He just gave that. He's an expert teacher. He gave that. So the idea is that should continue on. But for not having that training, we see much of the time devotees just dealt with the details and not the principles. To the point where certain things that I know that I learned as a bhakti about deity worship, devotees today still aren't being trained. It's if you get down into that world of that big controversy, is that when you pick up the artic lamp, do you just start with Krishna? Or do you offer it through the parampara and then get to Krishna? And then the reason that it's being spoken by those who say you just go to Krishna directly is because then you've offered it to Prabhupada, and then you can't offer the prasad to Krishna. But what I learned in those days is that you approach Krishna through the devotees. So you take their blessings and go through. And with their approval, then you can offer the lamp to Krishna. So the offering actually starts with Krishna, but you have to go through the others to get there. And then after that, then that what has been offered to the Lord then is offered to the devotees. It comes back down, and then it's showed to Tulsi and to the But that understanding is not being given to pujaris today.
So you're actually when you do the incense, you go through the parampara to Krishna, and then you go back down.
Yeah.
You actually offer it again down, like the incense.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
But that was what was being, because that's the principle. You approach the Lord through His devotees, and then whatever Krishna has goes back, is given to them. Yeah, it's prasad. So I mean, it's a very simple principle. But the principle in that day was explained to me very clearly, you know, as a, basically a new devotee, and that's how we did in the temples there and any place else you went. They had the same understanding, but then somehow another. You know, those pujaris, if they went away, the next generation may or may not, then it just got lost, just like cooking. Prabhupada gave this wonderful, very high class, you know, aristocratic Bengali cooking to the devotees. But simple. He just gave it with cumin seeds. But the style of cooking and how it was done was like this very top class cooking. But then so many of the devotees who knew that left the temple. And the next generations of devotees didn't learn from them. And I haven't tasted that kind of cooking, you know, since, you know, the 70s. I once said there was one devotee who used to be a cook in the temple in the 70s. And then they had left the temple and were, because they liked to cook, they were cooking in their house. And then in the mid-80s, they invited me to the house once, and it was exactly the same kind of cooking. But that was the last time I've had it.
With cumin seeds, he said.
Yeah.
He didn't use any other spices.
Cumin, you know, turmeric, salt, and they use the, you know, red chili. The standard. You put the ghee, put in the chili, put in the cumin, throw
dried,
in the
dried whole chilies.
Yeah, dried whole chilies. Throw in the vegetable. They might throw in some hing. Throw in the vegetables. Put the salt, turmeric, mix it up, and then put a lid on it, because the salt takes the water out of the vegetables. So then it just steams in its own liquid. So then, that's a very, you know, sophisticated kind of cooking, because it was so simple. The devotees got enamored by the Gujaratis and their mustard seeds, mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff, and then they lost that one. It's one thing is you take that system. And then you learn how to, okay, this spice I can use with this vegetable, and that one goes nice with that. But the system of cooking, you don't lose. The devotees, somehow another, you know, most, it means those who are good cooks, you don't, you know, like excuse me, I did bump into it again with Jamuna, when she cooked. And now and again, means, in other words, it's individuals here and there. That they still know those old styles of cooking and they've expanded on them. But otherwise, in general, in the temple cooking, that's specifically what I mean, you don't find it. So it's just, it's lost. And but from what I would say is on this principle of not understanding that the principle and the fundamentals of the philosophy, which seems so simple and you can even give to a kid. You know, Prabhupada used to show that to the Hindus. He'd bring in an 8-year-old kid and go, "Who's God?" He'd say, "Krishna," like that. You know, and this big, you know, Sanskrit-speaking scholar can't figure out who's God and who's not. He's going, you know, in our society, even our kids could figure it out. You know, so is that because he gives the essence, and then from there, then you fill out. So once the essence is there, then all these others have meaning. So that way then the devotees get trained, you know. That was Mataji's point, is that it starts from there, then the training can be passed on. And depending upon, the Vedic system is give everyone the conclusions, and then depending upon their ability, then they learn that much detail. Like the essence of music, that is to be sung for the pleasure of Krishna. You know, one is supposed to, you know, done in, it's not for our own, you know, distinction, adoration, and profit. That it's, you know, we use our, you know, tunes and that of the acharyas, we use the songs of the acharyas, like that. then from there, depending upon, so everybody should know these basic principles, you know, and some basic how to play the kartals and how to play the mridanga, and that you can make the kirtan work. Then, if someone has greater ability in music, he may learn more ways to play kartals or more ways to play the mridanga or more tunes or more ways to use the tune. But it's all based on the fundamental principle is to please Krishna and nothing else. Well, generally the Western is you start with a technique and go through like this. So that's not so important. The Vedic will also use that technique if they are non-devotees. The non-devotee Vedic system will also teach more the technique, but they'll generally get to the purpose at some point. And if you don't learn it in the Gurukul, you'll learn it at Vanaprastha. Like that when one studies the Aranyakas. If one wasn't qualified enough to learn it in the Gurukul, well, then one will learn it in Vanaprastha. So one would get to the conclusions. But for us, because the philosophy is our main, the conclusions are given. Though in the material knowledge, then we may, you know, those aspects of memorization are given first, and then this. So there is a system. But Prabhupada gave that essential conclusions come first. Then from there you can expand into the technicalities. Did that deal with it, or did we?
Another question.
Little louder, please.
Another question is, as we are witnessing a gradual slackening in some areas in this land, what would you recommend as the a way to counteract the slackening?
For every individual, it's, how is he? Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that every individual has to go up to the door of self-realization themselves and knock. You know, so if we want to go back to Godhead, then we have to follow. Prabhupada said this mission will be successful if even one person goes back to Godhead. He'll consider all the time spent going around the planet 14 times and opening hundreds of temples and spending millions and millions of dollars worth useful if one soul goes back to Godhead. So then we should have the determination that at least we should try to be counted amongst those souls that make Prabhupada's endeavors successful. So that at least we do what we know we're supposed to do. And then if we can help others in their doing, nice, and if not, then at least we can keep ourselves steady.
Last night you were talking about the power and number principle, the Vaishya mentality and Sudra mentality. So that would seem to apply in this situation also, that if we don't concern ourselves so much with what everybody's doing, but we look at what Bhagavatam is suggesting we do,
that's
a better idea.
Yeah, that's always. The only thing is that if we have a natural ability to organize on a big level, that we can actually have that influence, then it's worthwhile seeing what can I do to what would be the most efficient way to, you know, bring everybody around. But if one doesn't have that, then it's better make one's own and associate with those devotees, like-minded devotees, so you find have that kind of mood, and that would be the most successful. You know, like that is associate with those who are serious. And if you can't find those who are serious, then at least practice yourself very seriously. And then like that, it'll grow. The Krishna consciousness grows, so it will grow. It's just a matter of just some, you know, everybody has different things they have to go through to learn. So it's like before, as we were doing the Vedic, and then there were some difficulties from not understanding it, not applying it, or not studying it seriously, as we discussed yesterday. So then one may lose some faith in that. So then we may have to just spend some time, as we see, as things don't necessarily always go in the, you know, I say, traditional ways. And then with time, you'll be seeing that those ways don't work either. And then it'll naturally come back. Any other questions?
Sometimes when people talk about Dhyan Ashram, they talk about developing a Grihastha Ashram. It seems a lot of times they're thinking of nuclear families. Is that really part of the Dhyan Ashram system?
Dhyan Ashram system would, you may have nuclear. I mean, the ideal is you have a joint family. It gives a lot more support. But nuclear could be there. But generally you'll find nuclear, it depends. I mean, sometimes you find, you know, the Brahmins on their own, but they live very simply, so there's no facility you have to get together for that. So it's not a big problem so much for them, because they don't keep anything. You know, like Sudama Brahman. You know, like that. Sometimes the artists may find themselves in that situation, because where they have to work, this and that. But generally they're connecting themselves to some other families. They're becoming part of the family of a Vaishya, or part of the family of a Kshatriya, or part of the family of a Brahmin. So generally they don't have that problem so much of the nuclear aspect.
There's also like a village would be another solution.
Yeah, the village is there, and you know.
Isn't that still in Puri, that there's like the Brahmin para, is it Brahmin
community
and like that?
Yeah, they all live there, and all the kids of the para are all, you know, I mean, those are para kids. They may be of a particular family, but everyone in the para, they have the same values, so anybody can instruct the kids. The kids are at the other end of the street, you know, in front of your house and misbehaving, then you'll come out and you'll tell them. And those children's parents won't come along, you know, 5 minutes later with an iron bar, you know, because they have community. You know, but when there's a difference in value, then you say anything to one kid's kid, you know, one person's kid, and the next thing you know is that, you know, all, you know, the embassies have been closed, the ambassadors have been removed, and, you know, all communications have been shut down between families. You know, that's if they're being a little subtle. Otherwise, then, you know, a 7-foot, 500-pound husband comes along and lets you know that, you know, don't mess with their what do you call it? Bundle of joy that dropped out of the heavenly planets. You know? So it's the, I forget what was your original point. Okay.
Yeah.
Means it's, the point is if the mentality is understood, then those who have a common understanding, they'll actually bond together. Like that, that's natural. So either you have a big family, or the village is a family, the community is a family. You know, both. It's. But those, the values must be common. So the Vedic system is, you know, is training must be there for everybody. Because if we want to socially get together, Grihastha is the second stage. You know, you can't start with the second stage. You know? I mean, just like you want to start a business, you can't start, you have to start with the first thing. I have to get capital. Right? Then once you get capital, then you can purchase things, then you can start to sell things. So if we want to say, well, we have to get Varnashram together, so we have to, the main problem is Grihasthas, we have to get the Grihasthas together. You can only get the Grihasthas together if you get the Brahmacharis together. Right? And the Brahmacharis together means they're trained as Brahmacharis. If it's a matter of let's get the Brahmacharis together, they're not Brahmacharis, so let's get them all married, that means a lack of understanding of Varnashram. It means first they, until they become Brahmacharis, then the it makes it a lot easier as Grihasthas. And if they want to get together, we say, well, we already have the Grihasthas, we have to get them together, then they have to be, the men and women have to be trained in the principles that they should have learned before they got married. They should have discussions and you know, somehow or another studies in that. So then they gain the background that makes then the Grihasthasram work. If getting it together is simply just economic, but the economics won't happen until the prescribed duties are there. It doesn't work like that. We may say otherwise, but that means we don't understand how the material world works. We don't understand. Because if materially we did, then we might say, well, no, we do understand. And if materially they did understand, then why is it they don't have money? They already understood. You're not 40 years old and don't have money. You know. You may say, well, I spent 20 years, in the temple life. But then, if you know how to do it, you just do it. You know, I've seen people go from zero to, having, tens of thousands of dollars in that, just in a very short time, months or a few years, if they know how to do it. Like that. So, the point is we don't know how to do it. Otherwise, we would have already done it, because the people who know how to do it are doing it. Right? The people who know how to do it are doing it, they're not complaining. Right. So one has to understand is that opulence, development, all that comes from prescribed duties. The prescribed duties are there, then it works. And if it's not, the prescribed duties aren't there, no result will come. I mean, just a simple thing. Okay. We want to get opulence in the family. So the main thing that it talks about in the scriptures is that if you have a very, qualified, chaste woman in the family, she's like Lakshmi, and the whole family will prosper. And if she's not well-behaved, bad character, she'll destroy the whole family. So it seems one of the simplest things is just you see that women are sheltered and properly trained and cared for. And then automatically by their mood, everything comes. Right? One may say, no, that's not the thing. We have to have capital and money and investments. But can any man go out there and very happily, generate money if inside the house there's anxiety and problems? He won't have that inspiration. But if the relationship's very nice, he naturally takes that. Prabhupada's explaining that, is that before marriage, life is very simple. Right? But one will take the risk of maintaining the wife and the children and all the facilities because of the relationship that's there. Because of the happiness that is gained by that relationship. So therefore, someone will work very hard. But if the relationship's not there, then the inspiration to work is not. So you can bring in, there's people who are, millionaires, billionaires, and their whole empire goes down because their family broke up. They divorced. Just the whole thing just falls right apart. The reason the guy is a billionaire is because that's how he wants to take care of his family. That's the prestige and the facility and all that he wants for his family. And then when the family unit falls apart, then he can't go on anymore. He doesn't pay attention. He can't get into making the decisions, going to the meetings, you know, putting in the long hours, and the whole thing disappears. Like that. It's a very common thing. It's not uncommon at all. So the whole point is when the women in the community have that mood, the whole community is opulent.
Isn't the statement of Manasamhita also that there's quarreling between husband and wife, there'll never be Lakshmi in the house?
Yeah, I think something like that is there. So it's because all that, because then there's dissatisfaction. When there's dissatisfaction, it doesn't matter. See, opulence in the house is also a matter of mentality. Is you can have, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars and still think you're poor. And someone can have nothing and be rich. Because rich is a mentality. It's not what you have. You know? I mean, so that's why there's always the comment of the nouveau riche. Nouveau riche have money, but they're not actually rich. Because they're always trying to show, always trying to this, just, you know. Because those who are actually rich, they're very simple. You know? You'd see that, the big babus who come from Calcutta, they're very, very rich. They come in a simple dhoti, you know, white, clean, starched dhoti, and white, clean, starched kurta, and many times even just, you know, plastic buttons. You know, these, you know, you have the double hole and you insert them, they're separate, like that, and just they're very clean and nice. But the ones who are like the upcoming ones, then they always try to look like they're rich, you know, show their wealth and all that. That's coming now in India also. Now the rich are showing their wealth, but before they didn't. So it's wealth is a mentality. Opulence is a mentality. I mean, something like a garland, that's opulence. You know? So it also depends upon what you value as opulence. So that was just an example of one thing, but that's prescribed duties. It goes back to the prescribed duties. Then from that, the other, because you sell something doesn't make you rich. Or just because you take taxes doesn't make you rich. It's your mentality and your training and all that. Yeah. There is technique, of course, how to properly spend money and save money and all these things. Yeah. But that's secondary to the actual mentalities that are there in the whole culture and the families and all that. Yeah. If the husband can't give, you know, proper protection and shelter and be sensitive to the needs of the family, then also the members of the family aren't going to be inspired. So then they're not going to behave in such a way that he'll be inspired. So none of these have anything to do with money and having done Sankirtan for the last 20 years or given the best part of my life, or it has nothing to do with any of that. Right? I mean, Sankirtan's preaching. One should know how to be sensitive to people and how to deal with people and all those kind of things. One is distributing the philosophy, one should have imbibed it. So just that someone could say that means that there's something wrong. Right? They didn't imbibe the philosophy. They may say, well, you got to be practical. You need money to live, you know, none of this philosophy stuff. But how does money come? That means just this, you know, Alfred Ford, you know, he worked for his money. He was born rich. So how did that happen? In previous life, he's done something, some prescribed duty that created the money in this lifetime. And generally, if one is over there, that means something happened here. And that's on the way down. Right? Earth in the West is generally on the way down from India. You know, so probably he was more wealthy in that before, and now there's just something is there. You know, just like that. Now just something is there. Does that make sense? So the thing is, when you get the Grihastha Ashram together, then the principles of the Brahmacharya Ashram must be imbibed in the ones who will become Grihasthas and in the ones who are Grihasthas. Like that. Plus, then one has to cultivate the older devotees, you know, the elders. It's those who know how to run the system. Who have been successful, then one should take advice from them, and that should be encouraged. Like that. Then you're going to get things to work. Like that.
It seems that, as you were saying, the temple is like an extended family, and then Prabhupada established farming communities. Ideal opportunities for developing communities.
Yeah.
It seems that devotees are tending to go on there by themselves a lot more.
Because the farm community means you have to be able to adjust to the rural environment, you know, and the simpleness there. And generally most devotees didn't come from that background. They're all urbanites, so they can't relate to the farm. You find most farms devotees still live in urban lifestyle. It's a suburb, it's not a farm. Those who are farmers are considered weird. Like that. I've seen on the farms, the farmers themselves that know how to actually grow the crops are not the ones who make policy on the farm. They're not allowed, they're crazy. You know? This is just work, you know? Like that. It's much easier. You want to make money, you get in your $50,000 car, the roll of paintings and go out and make money, you know. What's all this growing potatoes stuff, you know? Like that, so they just think they're crazy. And many times they're not very sophisticated because they did come from a rural background. Like that. They are simple and unsophisticated. So naturally the sophisticated city slicker, why is he going to listen to a village bumpkin? So like that, then farming communities don't work.
I heard an interesting quote from Srila Prabhupada where they were talking about Varnashram and training Varnashram College. So they're talking about the Vaishyas, and Prabhupada was saying, you know, that they farm, things like that. And the devotees were saying, oh, we can also train them in business. Prabhupada said, what is this nonsense business? Vaishya means producing from the land. Exact quotes, I don't know, but that was the move.
Mm.
So that was also interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's only once you produce something, then you can. Because the Vedic thing is even you're doing business, you're doing it in things that people need. You know? Cloth, they need pots and pans, like that. They need other, you know, clay utensils, you know, things made of wood. Furnitures and things like that. Simple stuff. That's what they actually need. So when we say business, we're selling anything but that. You know? Right? You have any devotees in America, they're dealing in grains or cooking utensils. Or a few will deal in spices. You know? Like that. Okay, I think we'll end here.
Yeah, it's just a practical question. Tomorrow it's fasting till sunset. Will there be class tomorrow?
Tomorrow I'll be going into Calcutta with Sahuja Maharaj because I have to go to a program in Bombay. It just kind of suddenly came up.
And also on this Vyasa Puja poster,
It does say that. I found out today. In the fine print. Yeah, no, I just, Purushottam Maharaj mentioned that about a month ago, and that's what I thought the whole ceremony was, I mean, the whole festival was going to be about. But then some devotee came and talked to me the other day, and they were just talking about the ceremonies. So I didn't understand from that they were actually doing the seminars. So I was, only now that I'd made all this arrangement for this Bombay program, and I found out today from Maharaj and then from the fine print on the card that there actually is seminars woven in between the ceremonies. So it's, I didn't, so it seems that there's only one. There were supposed to be 2 days on the 25th, 26th, so the morning one on the 25th, that one looks like I can do.
How long will you be away now?
Then about, I think it's about a week, the whole thing. Like that. It's a DD installation, like that, it's small.
So the morning of the 25th, you will do a seminar, but none of the others.
Tomorrow morning. There's a Bhagavatam class, and it seems, I was under the impression that it was the Bhagavatam class, but it seems the Bhagavatam class is one thing, and then there's a class at 10 o'clock, that's another thing. So then those two will go on, and then after that, then we'll go to Calcutta. I'm not exactly sure. It just seems that there's a Bhagavatam class, and then there's this something on, supposed to be on Ram Lila, and then the Abhishek is at 11, and then generally 12 o'clock is the Aarti. Exactly how everything else goes, I don't know.
When does the eating start?
I don't know what's the temple.
Sunset, isn't it?
Generally, that's the time when he appeared, was at sunset, like that. Because he's Ramachandra. This is that aspect of the, I think, appeared at the, when the moon rose. Yeah. So then that aspect is there. Though, there's some different quotes. The Hochamaras was telling me about it. Is that there's one quote where the devotees, I forget where it was. It was in India. And it was like, I forget what time it was, and Prabhupada, you know, made a comment and says, so, you know he got the idea, he said, it doesn't appear that devotees are taking Vishad, why no one's taking Vishad, is Vishad late or something, and they said, oh no, we were fasting until sundown, and Prabhupada, you know, made comment kind of like, you know, what's this nonsense, you know, they're supposed to be eating now, what's going on, but then at some other time, then Prabhupada had mentioned that it's the fasting until sunset. So I don't know the situation behind what was the cause of each one of those. I just heard about it yesterday. That's there, so both are there.
And is it usually with grains or?
Oh, that was a whole other thing. The old tradition is on the appearance day of any Vishnu Tattva deity that you take anakalpa, like that. Then the next day you have, you know, at the noon offering, you have a big feast. So in a festival there must be remembrance of the personality. There must be some special pujas or special worship, and there must be a feast. So now if one is willing to do it over a 2-day period, then one can do like that. One can do anakalpa on the day and have a big feast the next day. But if one's not going to do that, one wants to have the feast on the same day, then it should be grains, unless it's an ekadasi program. So the only two that seems to be a little more strictly followed like that, but not all in all places, is, at least in Mayapur, Gaur Purnima, Janmashtami, and for some, then the Sringa Chaturdasi, like that. But other temples, they have various. But that's the tradition, is those must be there. So normally they would have it the next day, but many just feel that's inconvenient, so they have it on the day. So feast means grains. The point is, after fasting, it's not the time to have a big feast. So you just break it with something light, and then next day, then things are more adjusted, and then you can honor a feast. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jai Nitya Gaura Prema.